This is the People's Game, and of course the big headline in this part of the world is that the United States has bowed out of the tournament. They had one of the most exciting runs in the 2010 World Cup, and once again USA fell behind, came back and tied, but in the knockout rounds the game goes into extra time. Ghana scored right after the beginning of extra time, and USA was unable to come back. We'll talk with Nick Green of 100% Soccer about the USA's performance in this World Cup, and what you'll hear in that interview is the type of critical dialogue that exists across the world when it comes to soccer, a really serious analysis, not the kind of hollow cheerleading that takes place on sports talk radio where the people really don't understand the nuances of the game. Nick Green has followed this team for years, and this is the kind of incisive discussion about the strengths and flaws of the team, how it can move forward to become a better national side. So please listen to this, folks, and recognize this is an element of what makes national soccer teams strong, serious critical dialogue about the team. Then we're joined by the great Dave Zirin, America's leading progressive sports journalist, and we're going to talk about the political subtext of the 2010 World Cup team and, yes, of Team USA itself. And in the final segment, we'll be joined by Lazar Trishan, our beat reporter for Team Uruguay. He, of course, is sky high with the Sky Blues as they now have advanced into the quarterfinals. All that and more on the People's Team. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
I'm Pablo Morales.
And we're joined by Nick Green, he of the blog 100% Soccer, a journalist with The Daily Breeze, and someone who has followed Team USA very closely over the years. Nick Green, what did you think about today's performance?
It was something you could almost see coming when you heard the starting lineup. I was disappointed from the outset, and so was every American supporter I spoke with.
Yeah.
It really, as I'm going to write on my blog, I was just sitting here writing when you guys called, it really had a been there, done that feel, and it wasn't particularly overwhelmingly successful the first time around either. You know, Ricardo Clark coming in for Marie Seydoux, Robbie Finley back. It just felt unimaginative, and I saw it on the post-game remarks that Bradley said, well, Clark came in just because we needed fresh legs, and it didn't really seem like there was much tactical, coaching, nuanced decision-making there. It was very sort of reactive, if you like, from the outset. It wasn't.
What do you attribute to the fact that through the Bradley era, for sure, the U.S. has just had this penchant for giving up the early goal, and just how disheartening that is for the viewers?
Well, I think you have to ask about the coach. You have to ask whether a coach sends 11 players on the field well-equipped from the outset of the game. And I think you have to really call into question Bradley's decision-making before even a ball was kicked. And I think we saw that again today.
Right.
Giving up a goal that early, doing that again and again and again, it's obviously there's a lack of concentration or something's happening when the players are taking the field. I think it's today definitely was a lineup problem, and Bradley showed his own lack of confidence in his own lineup when he took Clark out so rapidly after they'd given up the goal. Like Pablo and I watched the game together, and we were really kind of surprised at that as much as the original decision to put him on the field, because it just sends a signal out to the whole team about a fundamental lack of confidence in the decisions that were made before the players took to the field.
Exactly what happened to Mexico when we beat them in the round of 16 in 2002, where they did the exact same thing by pulling out the left-sided defender after only 22 minutes. And it just sends a signal to the rest of your team that you don't have confidence in your own lineup.
Yeah.
You know, he sends out Ricardo Clark because he needs fresh legs. Clark gets caught in possession, promptly goes down a goal in the fifth minute. The next thing you know, he's got a yellow card. And that, by the way, Bradley said after the game was the reason he yanked him. The yellow card, not because he was playing awful and got caught in possession. Yeah, that was the first 45 minutes essentially repudiated every decision Bradley made when he sent the team out. And why he was sticking as he did with Jozy Altidore for so long.
Yeah,
I don't think Altidore had a particularly good tournament. And it just way too much loyalty to Altidore. Benny Failhaber really wasn't the answer. Where was Edson Buddle?
Yeah. I know. Everybody's wondering what was going on with that.
You figure with the chemistry that he's developed with Donovan at the Galaxy, that would have been something he would have tried earlier in the tournament to see whether this was going to be Buddle's. I mean, you look at what Buddle did in the warm-up game against Australia just seem to be ready to pull the trigger and do it well. I have a question for you. You know, I was looking back at some old notes and realized that that project 2010 that the U.S. started in 98, this is the year it was supposed to come to fruition. It got changed by Nike to Project 40 at some point. And I was looking back at what Rothenberg said about this was the year that supposedly the United States was to be competitive, not win the World Cup, but be competitive. What do you think? Do you think they reached that goal?
Yes, I think they reached that goal. I think the unfortunate part about this loss was that the team and the tournament seemed to be gaining momentum,
yeah.
And it was beginning to be recognized and picked up by the general American sporting public. So I think that's what many hardcore soccer fans feel is perhaps one of the worst things about this loss. But I have to question whether or not we should be sticking with Bob Bradley. Given his coaching decisions, I think it may be time for him to go. I think it's been a rather unimaginative tournament for him. And I think it really exposed not only his limitations, but the limitations of the lineup he's sending out there.
This is going to start the whole U.S. coach versus foreign coach debate that happens every almost every World Cup cycle. What are your feelings on that?
Well, I said before Bradley was hired that I'd like to see the U.S. go with a foreign coach. I felt that Bradley's hiring at the outset was just incredibly formulaic and was just was all about U.S. soccer's conservative philosophy to go from Bruce Arena to Bob Bradley. There's not much imagination there either, really, in terms of a choice. And I don't see where it would hurt. I think the American player has matured enough now that we don't need to have that old foreign coaches don't understand Americans. I think we can move beyond that, and I think it's time to give that a try.
You know, and sometimes an outside perspective, it can get a team seeing beyond its own habits and traditions, which have been maybe, you know, limiting their creativity on the field. And certainly when you have the same problem with giving up the early goal has become a signature of the team now. You know, I think you're right that that actually does indicate a problem on the strategic side of things. And maybe the men need to take a cue from the women. The women actually hired a foreign coach, Pia, I think you say her last name is Sundage. And she's just worked wonders with its side. I mean, they've been playing beautifully and masterfully under her. So
absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly with that. They really should look to Pia, because it's funny you mention that, because when you talk to Pia, she complains about some of these American women, female soccer players, and the way that they don't soak up the culture of the game like their counterparts do over in Europe. And I really think you need a coach to start talking about that when we're talking about the men's game as well, because, you know, you really get a feeling that there needs to be more of an ingrained soccer culture, and I'd rather hear about these guys watching endless tapes than playing Call to Duty while they're in their rooms or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, it's true. There's a disconnect between, especially in the youth ranks, where these kids by the thousands, you know, play club for, you know, 100 games a year and travel all over the United States to tournaments. But then you ask them about any European league, maybe outside of the EPL, and they have no clue. And even they don't even go to MLS games. They don't go to their local MLS games. So much of, you know, how you play or you reach a certain level is by actually witnessing somebody else doing it and replicating it. And I find that really sad when I look at the stands at the Home Depot Center and don't see all those kids, you know, that they should be watching the game.
Yeah,
I agree. I hope Landon Donovan gets a good reception. I hope fans come out to pay tribute to him, because he was one of the, again, one of the highlights of the tournament and deserves a great reception when he comes back to play
for
the Galaxy.
Can we talk a little bit about Ghana? Because we haven't actually said much about how they played today. They played a great game, and they earned that win.
Absolutely. Faster, sharper.
Yes.
Tactically aware, more managerially astute of managing the game, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
They did what they needed to do when they needed to do it. And it seemed like they, as much as the U.S. was going through this rote sort of script thing, Ghana knew exactly when to strike and to step in.
Yeah.
You know, early in the game, early in overtime, and in between, just stymie, frustrate, I thought they played a very good game. I don't think the U.S. fans or team can have any qualms at all. They were outplayed in every facet of the game today.
It was reminding me of an old AYSO coach that said some teams have the magic and some don't. And U.S. didn't have the magic today, but there were several situations where I saw that the Ghana players had that little extra bit.
Yeah. That second goal by Gyan, I mean, he was pushed and shoved. He muscled his way into making that shot. It was really a gorgeous goal. And when he put that away, I was just like, that's the win right there. And it was a really beautiful moment in football.
It was a smart thing for them to do tactically, because he's simply faster, stronger, and more skilled on the ball than Demerit and Bocanegra. I mean, I know both Pablo and Nick probably know these guys, but in all due respect to them, they can't keep up with him. And I saw that. I even tweeted about it, and I figured Howard would be the thing that maybe could stop him if they caught a quick counterattack, and it didn't happen.
Well,
he put the ball in the net.
It would have been interesting.
Sum up the U.S. defense for you, that goal?
Yeah.
That was like...
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Demerit was out of position, and Bocanegra was too slow. That was the whole thing. I mean, I would have loved to have seen Gooch. Do you know why Gooch wasn't playing, by the way?
I just don't. I think we saw why he wasn't playing during the minutes he did play. He was slow. He was clearly not match fit.
But his positioning is so much better than Demerit. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't misread the high ball like Demerit.
Yeah, sure does, yeah.
So,
well,
I mean, at some level...
Gooch plays for AC Milan. Demerit is just leaving Watford.
Yeah. Does that say it all?
I did see the game a little differently than the three of you, I think, because I did think that the United States had... obviously, when they were behind, Ghana tried to absorb them. They were creative at times. I just think they burned themselves out, and I think they had nothing left in their tank by the overtime. It was rather obvious. But I thought even after their goal, they actually were the more dangerous side until about the final whistle blew for the 90 minutes, the last, say, 8 to 5 minutes of that period. But from about 68 to 83 still after the goal was scored, I thought USA remained the more dangerous side.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I rapped on the table at the bar where we were, and I said, they're knocking on the door, because you felt that way for a spell. And it was, you know, Dempsey played better the closer he got to the goal.
Yeah.
The penalty, by the way, was created with his first real penetrating run into the box, and it created the Donovan equalizer. And so there was a period where you thought that perhaps the U.S. might break through, but Ghana just managed the game.
And it's strange, because you wouldn't think a USA team would hit fatigue like that, hit a wall like they did. I think it has to do with the drama and the kind of exertion they had to go through, both sort of psychically with the goals being taken away in the group stage and the comebacks, and then having to come back against, you know, how much it takes out of a team to come back from being down so often for them. And while they didn't have to do that with Algeria, they were in effect down.
I still think Bill Clinton should not have been in the locker room after the last game. I put it on Bill.
I think the quality of beer was it. No, Budweiser's just don't cut it.
You know,
the problem was when you have more star power in the stands in the form of Mick Jagger and Bill Clinton on the field in the U.S. lineup. That probably was the real problem.
Landon Donovan back in 2014, Nick?
He better be. There is still no other American player, who can compare to Landon Donovan. That's for sure. We saw that again in this tournament.
Yeah.
I don't think we're ever going to see the phrase Landy Cakes ever again.
Thank God.
And even though he's probably already lost a step or two, and he probably will lose another step or two, his game will change. He's a smart enough player. I just hope his dream comes true and he gets a big money move when the transfer market.
He's earned it.
Yeah.
And Pablo and Nick, how do the youth ranks look for Team USA?
Well, I mean, I don't follow that much beyond the USL. I don't know much about the developmental lower leagues that much, but I do watch some USL. And I have to say that almost every team has at least one or two players that I could envision becoming decent national team players. Or, you know, it's a tight enough community, in my opinion, Nick, you can speak, that still a real gem like a Landon Donovan doesn't evade detection for very long and is soon picked up and these days shipped off, oftentimes still a teenager, to Europe. I think it's really the ability to grow a large body of good players, professional players, there's never been more opportunities than there is today, and there'll be more tomorrow. It's just really just going to keep growing in that regard.
Nick?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's some young players that didn't make the squad this time around that we could see in four years from now, like Robbie Rogers, Sasha Kljestan. Players like that, I think, are already going to improve and could step in. And the U.S. Officials will tell you their U-17 ranks are a rainbow of colors, of nationalities. From that perspective, given the coming demographic wave in this country, things look up, and I'd like to see a lot more Torreses and Gomezes on the field. And we haven't even talked about Torres. I'd like to see a lot more of those surnames on the field, and I think we will in the future.
Speaking of such surnames, the World Cup, of course, goes ever on and into a glorious set of matches tomorrow.
Oh,
first off, Argentina, Mexico, your thought there, Nick, one of the other home sides for Southern California, of course, for Koreatown. South Korea went out today, even with a sea of red in central Los Angeles, watching it outside Radio Korea on Wilshire. But Mexico plays Argentina. If Mexico wins, it will be a historic win for Mexico. But again, for the second straight World Cup in the second round, a Mexico team that has at times been quite impressive has to go up against Argentina. What do you think of that, Nick?
Two great games tomorrow.
Yeah.
As you know from my accent, I'm more concerned about the first one. But the second one, Argentina and Mexico, it'll be wonders of Messi orchestrating against what is probably the best Mexican team that we have seen since a couple of decades here.
Yeah, 86 so, might be the only one.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be interesting to see just how Mexico matches up to Messi and the firepower of Argentina. I'd really like to see Mexico take a few more risks. I want to see Chicharito on the field more rather than coming on as a sub. That will be a fascinating game. Tomorrow is going to be a great game of two great games of football.
And the first match tomorrow, England versus Germany. You have some roots there with England, and the two sides have quite a history.
Yeah, they're always great games when Germany and England play. I'll be watching it wearing my England shirt at Alpine Village, the local German hangout in South Bay.
Oh, brave man.
I will be my wife's best friend is here, and she's married to a Berliner, so she'll be wearing German gear. So it should be very, very interesting. The way England have played up till now in this tournament, I'm not particularly optimistic of England's chances, frankly.
Well, the way they've played, it would seem to almost preclude the possibility of a great game. Could be a close game in terms of the score, but a great game. England has shown nothing of greatness on the pitch so far in the 2010 World Cup.
Yeah,
it could be a goal here or there, huh? It really feels that way. That's all this game will have. That's all that will be needed. One mistake, either side will have it. But the efficiency of the Germans has certainly looked better in this tournament than the brightness and inventiveness of the likes of Wayne Rooney.
Yeah, and people should be keeping their eyes open for Ozil, the striker, the German striker, who...
Closer?
No, Ozil. Ozil.
Old playmaker.
Yeah, I mean, people have been... there's a lot of hype around him as being a real future superstar in soccer, and I'm beginning to think that they might not be wrong about that.
Yeah, no, he is catching the eye with every passing game. He's looking better and better, I agree.
Yeah.
And that's been a big part of Germany's success, I think.
Yeah, and an interesting little note, I've been in contact with a friend of mine who's watching these games in Germany, and I mean, Ozil, as some of the press has actually spoken about, is of Turkish background, and so there was a big wrestling match over who he was going to play for, and it's a big deal to have him be the face of the German side, being of Turkish immigrant background. I believe he's of working class background, and so that's kind of an interesting sort of social context for understanding his importance as a face for the German team. So
yeah, well, Turks are the biggest immigrant group in Germany, from what I understand,
and very passionate football fans.
Very.
Right, and very important for Germany as a society to have somebody of that ancestry playing for the German national team.
And the Brits, they do great self-flagellation when they lose, so we'll see what goes down there.
Oh, we can trust that the British the British press will give us lots to read and mull over whatever happens tomorrow. So,
but I'll say this about England. For all the grumpiness, and it's merited, the only goal they gave up was the howler by Green. So the back line's doing something right, and we'll see if Germany can break through. So it should be a great match, even if it's not.
Yeah. And considering their records in the World Cup for for penalty kicks. I would imagine that at some point England, if it's really late in extra time, they'll just turn around and score an own goal so they don't have to suffer through that again.
Yeah, David James will just drop it down and kick it in his own goal.
Oh, gosh.
Nick Green, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game, and we'll have you back.
Fun chatting with you all, as usual.
Nick Green, the blog is 100% soccer. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
And I'm Pablo Morales.
And we are joined now by Dave Zirin, the preeminent progressive sports journalist in America. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. He is also the author of The People's History of Sports.
To be called the most progressive sports journalist is like, I guess, being called the most pacifistic Republican.
Dave Zirin, welcome to The People's Game.
Thank you so much.
Dave, I just want to say I love your blog, Edge of Sports. I very much recommend it to our listeners if you're not already familiar with it.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's been a lot of fun to do, and one of the things I've learned from it is that there are a lot of people out there like us, like you, me, Pablo, and Alan. I mean, people who really do love sports but don't want to feel like we're checking our politics at the door and then shut our mouths when sports reflects all the things that we demonstrate against when we're not watching sports.
Here's a really arcane reference. You know, Yoko Ono and John Lennon used to do these things called bag-ins back in the 60s, bagism. I don't know if you remember that. It's like in Give Peace a Chance, what the heck are they talking about?
And they used to just the gleam in my father's bloodshot eye in the 60s.
And Yoko Ono used to say, and this is really obtuse, but it's from Yoko Ono back in the 60s, that if she could be in one of these bags with Adolf Hitler, he would never have perpetrated the crimes against humanity perpetrated. This sort of, you know, intimate form of communication. My line on it is all the people who aren't soccer fans, if they just hung out with me and my friends and watched one soccer game, by the end of the game, they'd be soccer fans. My take also is if you do that one, two, three times, by the end of it, if you're like a moderate or a conservative, I'll convert you into being a radical leftist.
I'm actually a performance studies scholar, so I'm actually picturing, if I remember right, the bagism is it was a large bag
right.
That people would step inside. They would step inside the bag together. So it'd be a little bit like living and wrestling inside one of a big soccer ball.
Indeed, indeed. But again,
okay, we digress.
And the point I'm trying to make is to concur with Dave, which is that the text of sports can be a entry into a welcoming way for people to receive a radical political critique, find it friendly, and find it on point.
Absolutely and positively, and that's been the thing I've heard, which is honestly where I just feel the best about doing this kind of work is when people tell me things like, hey, my family's really right-wing, but I gave them your book or showed them an article, and because it was sports, all the walls didn't come up right away. Like, oh, you're trying to convert me to some leftist project or whatever. And they were actually able to then actually have a talk about things like racism, sexism, or homophobia, and just be able to do it through the language of sports, which I think for a lot of people is just less threatening.
Yeah, I just want to say I really appreciated what you wrote, how you responded to the U.S. victory against Algeria, which was both to celebrate the victory but to ask this very basic question, and I think it's one that haunts a lot of us. You know, why must an insanely miraculous athletic victory also be a reinforcer of cultural supremacy? And I feel that now we're actually kind of on the other end of that that question, sort of in a slightly different place in response to the U.S.'s performance today against a very valiant Ghanaian team.
It's one of those things where it's like the politics are part of it, Jennifer, whether we want it to be or not. I mean, we can say we don't believe in gravity. It won't help us when we fall out of an airplane. And so we can say, oh, the U.S. beat Algeria, and all that is the U.S. beating Algeria, and it's the World Cup, and you root for the U.S. because you're an American. But then you turn on sports radio like I did, and you hear the announcer say, well, the Algerians are just terrorists, and what the hell is Algeria anyway? It's a setting for an Abbott and Costello movie. And it's just like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I think it's definitely true in World Cup soccer. You have different kinds of nationalisms. I mean, just think about in 2002 when France played Senegal. It's interpreted in profoundly different ways, whether you're France, which used to be the colonizer of Senegal, or whether you're Senegal and you're actually celebrating that you defeated France. It may not have been defeating them on the battlefield. It may not be defeating them in the United Nations, but you're defeating them nonetheless through the representation of sports. And there is a political undercurrent there that's very real. And today with Ghana, I mean, I just filed my article about it, and I just kept thinking about the fact that the African teams, this is, everyone's saying it, it's the marketing hook, this is Africa's World Cup. The African teams underperformed dramatically in the opening rounds. To have Ghana, the last Africa team left, advance over the United States and to see people celebrate across the continent, I think one would have to be absolutely politically tone deaf to not see that there's something else going on with those celebrations.
And Ghana, and the first independent head of state of Ghana, Nkrumah, was a great Pan-Africanist, too.
Absolutely.
And the Black Star throws back to that era.
It is the avatar of African independence, the country of Ghana. And their very name, the Black Stars, comes from the sculpture, the monument in Ghana of the large black star, meant to represent the fact that they were the first true independent nation in Africa, the first decolonized independent nation. And, I mean, part of it also is, I could just tell you this because, you know, I was in South Africa for some time before the start of the World Cup, and these aren't secrets. I mean, everybody knew that there would be more Americans watching World Cup games in the stadiums than non-South African Africans, for all the talk of it being an African World Cup. Everybody knew that more McDonald's would be sold than African food at the World Cup. Everyone knew that FIFA had the trademark lock, stock, and barrel on all the goods that would be sold. And everyone knew as well that no matter what the outcome of the World Cup, the West would win and Africa would lose economically. So to have them have some victory on the pitch, it's not meaningless. It's not bread and circuses. It's not irrelevant. I mean, there's something real there that I think people need to reckon with.
Yeah, I find it really moving too, watching. I mean, I thought it was a very tense game, and they brought everything, the Ghanaian players. I mean, they brought everything to the field, both defensively and offensively. They threw everything but the kitchen sink at the U.S. I mean, it was a great win, and it was well-deserved. I mean, the goals they scored were well-deserved goals. I mean, just...
No question about it. Yeah. No question about it. And I really do feel like if the U.S. had ended that game against Algeria in a tie and had been sent home from the World Cup without having lost a single game, that would have been something very bitter to swallow, because in several of those games there were questionable calls, whether you're a U.S. fan or not, whether you want to see the U.S. lose or root for the U.S. It would have been a very ugly end to a team that had a lot of hopes with them. But today, I mean, they were outplayed. The Ghanaian team in the first half dominated, and in the second half, their goalkeeper, Richard Kingston, put on an absolute clinic, and I think reminded a lot of us of what Tim Howard, the keeper for the U.S., really hasn't done in this World Cup. Tim Howard has made every save he was supposed to make, but as far as making that spectacular save, we didn't really see that from Tim Howard, and we saw it from Richard Kingston.
That's fair. You know, I just think it's really sad as a U.S. fan that it had to be the U.S. that had to play Ghana in this round. I thought about it. It's like if this had only been Germany that Ghana had beat, or England, you know, that how much sweeter that would have been. Because I really wanted African nations to do well in this tournament. So I was really twisted in terms of my loyalties right up until kickoff when it was all red, white, and blue. But now I definitely am looking forward to supporting Ghana and hoping they get all the way. This would be wonderful for the sport and the continent.
It would. The only other team I'm rooting for is the team I picked at the part of the tournament, and that's just part of the weird culture of sports writing. You know, if I'm right about that, some random pick I made a couple weeks ago, then I get to say I'm smart.
And that was Argentina, I understand.
That is true.
Uh-huh. Right. But Argentina and Diego Maradona has cloaked himself in the rhetoric of the radical left. So there's more to it than just your prediction, perhaps.
That is true. And I'm one of those people who believes, you know, maybe quaintly, maybe naively, that when sports is played beautifully, it does rise to the level of art, and it has the capacity to really, really inspire people, and, you know, maybe even inspire people politically. And I put people like Steve Nash in that category. Like, I actually feel inspired when I see Steve Nash play basketball. And you know who else I feel inspired by is Lionel Messi. And I love watching him play. There's something kismet-ish about the idea of Diego Maradona, who Pele accused of only coaching the team because he ran out of money. But Maradona, the crazy Maradona, being the coach of the World Cup winning team.
And the Maradona who speaks in Buenos Aires and calls out President Bush and says he's not welcome on the continent of South America, that he's an imperialist and a colonialist in 2005.
That is true. Hmm. That is true.
Dave, soccer in the United States and the World Cup, the right wing's hatred of it. One of the things we've spoken about a lot on this show is the issue of soccer and the resistance to soccer within the domestic United States by the sports establishments, by the sports media establishment. What do you make of the last month, the hype around the U.S. team, the real huge amount of money invested from Disney, ABC, ESPN to the World Cup tournament? To my mind, and I'm a soccer partisan, a football partisan, I see, you know, football, I do think that the right has something to fear. I think this is an entry point into internationalism, to solidarity with the joy that people have in the most popular sport in the world, as opposed to the sort of nothing against the American sports that are popular, but the insulated culture of American sports in the United States.
Well, let's take it at that last point there, because it's also hilarious to hear the right-wing blabosphere say, we like American sports like football and baseball. And it's like, the roots of baseball are actually in England, and the roots of football are in rugby. Yeah. So what are you really talking about, this idea of this authentic
Actually,
American
the roots
sport?
Of football is football. I mean, otherwise, why would they have that name? The rugby is also a form of football. They just decide to pick it up and carry the ball. I think it's also interesting that it's the one thing that seems to be capable of uniting a Beck and a Obermann is this fear of international sports. You know, I think that's an amazing thing. That shows how powerful it is, I guess.
Yeah, and except I do think that there's a difference there, because I think Obermann sounds like an absolute ignoramus when he talks about football, soccer, but Beck, I mean, it really is linked to this broader political fear of the other, kind of hyper-nativism. And if you go back and go to Media Matters, which is so brilliant about these things, and you listen to Beck's rants against soccer, it's always linked to this idea of Obama. And he, I mean, I wish Obama was the Obama that he so fears, quite frankly. I don't recognize the Obama that he describes. But when he attacks Obama, he's not really attacking the Barack Obama who's disappointed a great many of us. He's attacking this sort of, in his mind, avatar of global equality.
Yeah, it's like basically some kind of mishmash of gay, women, Latino, soccer-playing, socialist art people. Right, that's sort of all balled up into this sort of trope, right? Of
I mean, what you just described sounds like a fun weekend.
Yeah, totally.
and to Glenn Beck, it's something to make money off of by stoking everybody's reptile brain for their darkest fears of some sort of other. Mm-hmm. That's what he does for a living, and he threw soccer in with that. And one of the things I wrote about this a couple weeks ago was that I thought it would be a lot of fun to see the U.S. do a run. To see the far right caught in a vice between wanting to get on the bandwagon of the attendant patriotism and what they've already laid out, which is that soccer is some sort of socialist, Marxist, gay, whatever.
that was a great piece, by the way. I sent that to a lot of my friends who don't quite get the link, and they really enjoyed it.
And what's so funny, too, is the right-wing blabosphere also picked up that article, and their comment on it was, that I was saying Americans are racist who hate soccer. And it's so funny to me because they say that because they actually look at Glenn Beck as an archetype of what is America. And that's part of this discussion, too. What is America? It's like when Sarah Palin has the nerve to say we are all Arizonans.
Right. Oh, God.
You know, what is the we that she is talking about? Yeah. Who are the Americans who Glenn Beck represents? It's a shrinking demographic in this country.
Yeah, and that's really where it comes from, right? Is that impending sense of one's own irrelevance. I mean, that's this kind of this sense of fear, right, that he's on the losing side, and I think he knows it, you know. You see this, I think, in a lot of different kinds of structures of powers at the moment. I've been thinking a lot about what's been going on with the French Football Federation, for example, and the kind of decaying structures of European football and how they look in relationship to The young people who are fans of the sport, the young people who are playing the sport. It's a very different sort of generational and political spaces of contemporary European culture. And that, to me, looks like, say, the structure of the University of California, which is my employer, a disconnect between our students, faculty, and administration, also reflecting larger kinds of problems in the power structures in California. And soccer, you know, it actually brings up some of these sorts of larger structural problems around the racialization of class, for example. Major generational and demographic right. differences are actually being played out around this sport in really powerful and amazing ways, which you've been writing about for quite a while, which is
The hilarious thing, or it's not hilarious at all, but the obvious thing would be if Beck actually gave soccer a chance. Well, it's not in his financial interest to do so because it's too useful as this avatar of the other.
Yeah.
But if he actually did give it a chance and enjoyed it, you might be able to connect with some of the patriotism, like Uncle Sam's Army, that's out there, that I actually do think has a pretty serious right-wing tinge
yep.
to it.
Yep.
And I think that's what ABC and ESPN have really made an effort to do.
Yeah.
Actually, you know,
make it politically neutral, but also in terms of linking it with the armed forces and showing a lot of the USA
yeah.
of troops in Afghanistan when I watch the goals of trying to politicize it in a way as well.
You know, the funny thing, too, is because, you know, we're down here in Southern California, and I sometimes refer to it on the show as Greater Mexico. You know, there's no doubt that as popular as Team USA became, I think, in the past weeks, obviously, they're games were very dramatic. The team was very resilient. They won a lot of people over. Mexico, the passion for Mexico in Southern California is super intense. I found myself drawn to the USA team like I never did before. They cut to the troops in Afghanistan. That chills my enthusiasm for them so much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to do that.
Well, they do it. I don't think they have to do it, but they do it, you know. I would never expect them not to, let's put it that way.
Right, yeah. Right. I interviewed a lot of the Sam's Army guys down in Mexico City just before the qualifier down there, and I think there are two distinct camps within those groups.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely the hardcore nationalists, but I find them to be the least soccer sophisticated of the bunch. The ones that are truly, you know the game, played the game perhaps, I'll even say that. A lot of them were Hispanic. A lot of them didn't get along with some of the more, you know, radical members within their own organization. But they felt that the United States deserved a cheering section like every other soccer nation in the world. And that's where their motivation came from, is that there should be a group of fans that the players can run to and know that they've got their undying loyal support. And in that regard, I tip my hat off to them.
Well, yeah. even before the Bush era, when clearly the United States had sort of re-entrenched as this symbol of super agro-imperialist domination, as opposed to the sort of
Global cop.
Yeah, global cop, right. I had a very ambiguous relationship to Team USA because I had this experience as a child in the late 70s, early 80s of moving to Italy. And all I cared about in Italy was being as good as everyone else. I came back to the States, and I was great at soccer in the States. So all of a sudden I start thinking, you know, I went to a school that played soccer. Well, what World Cup team would I have played for if I had been only a little bit better, because I was pretty good, was Team USA. My heart was not with them. I thought, like a lot of people do around the world, didn't really want USA becoming like an interloper in the sport. They have anything else. Keep them out of this. They wreck everything with their glitzy faux culture, corporate culture crap. Keep them out of the beautiful game. And, you know, there was a lot of sentiment. But I think the USA team, and just in its quality and the quality of its players, And the fact that I think generally the team doesn't carry itself with a lot of, like, you know, imperialist super cop bravado. I think they actually have gained entry into the international football community in a decent way.
Yeah, a lot of casual fans don't realize the behind the eight ball that most good soccer players from the United States start in. I remember this one story about Todd Ramos when he played in Spain. When he did something well, he was an Uruguayan-born player. When he did something bad, he's one of those crappy U.S. soccer players, you know, and that's sort of where it comes, you know, that's what they have to get overcome.
Jennifer?
No, I was just thinking that when you root for women's football, you're not really burdened with all of these sorts of problems.
Except when Bill Clinton showed up at the 99 finals against China, that had an undercurrent. There was something there, although with Clinton, I might have been misinterpreting what.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about that.
Yeah, let's not go there.
What was your take then on Team USA and the sort of political undercurrents of its ride in the 2010 World Cup?
Well, gosh, I mean, I thought they played an inspiring brand of soccer. I think we've definitely crossed the Rubicon in this country in terms of both popularity of the sport. I think the World Cup helped lift dramatically, and in terms of the quality of players we have, because now over half of our players play in Europe. Our goalkeeper, Tim Howard, he's the best goalkeeper in the entire English Premier League, I would argue. So it's like it's a brand new world, and I think the ceiling and expectations moving forward for every World Cup should be quarterfinals or semifinals, and that's going to undoubtedly help with the growth of the sport. That being said, I think politically, I'm one of those people who I think is going to be somebody who likes rooting for the underdog. And for a lot of people, they've rooted for the United States over the years because they were the underdog. And those days are done. So I don't think the U.S. will be seen as an underdog again. And so that means politically, I think we might want to start looking at some other countries if we want to see a Rocky Balboa moment.
Yeah.
And what do you think about soccer in this now new level of popularity in the United States related to an entry point into ideals of social justice and internationalism?
Well, I think whenever we think about these things, it always has to be conscious. This is the work of you, Jennifer, you, Alan, you, Pablo. It's the work of me, because I really don't think when it comes to sport, unless you have an athlete like an Ali or a Steve Nash who actually speaks out, I don't think it happens organically. I think it's about people being inspired by play and what play represents, and then us engaging with what it represents and trying to articulate it in a way that actually connects with fans.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think that also it's that they, in a way, I think players need our support in our engagement.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's the rare player who's willing to actually put their career on the line ahead of everything to take up really important political issues. Many of them are young and not confident in taking strong political stances against the organizations that are supporting their play. And I think of our critical engagement with the sport as a way of supporting the sport and supporting the people who play it.
And that beautifully. Hear, hear.
And Dave, if you have time ever and want to look into something amazing, look at the fans' efforts of the great British clubs Liverpool and Manchester United to take them out of the hands of the global financial capitalists among them.
My book comes out in late July. It's called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, and I have a chapter on Liverpool.
I'll bet you
it's
do.
It's brilliant stuff. And again, you're so right, though, about keeping that stuff conscious, because this is the place where we remind people of this and that these sports can be taken back by the people from the clutches of global capital.
Hey, if you want to talk about the book, particularly the Liverpool chapter, when it comes out, I'd love to come on.
Oh, we would love to have you on to talk about that. Jeez. Thank you for giving your time to us. We're really so pleased to have had you on the show today.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
My privilege.
Thank you so much, Dave.
You guys, good work, too.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
And I'm Pablo Morales.
And we're joined now by Lazar Trishan. He has a great blog called No More Onion Bags, where recently it's been very focused upon the Uruguayan national team, of which he is a partisan. Congratulations on the victory today, Lazar.
Thank you so much. They're dancing in the streets in Montevideo.
Have you had a chance to look at the Uruguayan media and see what they're saying?
They're thrilled. They're thrilled.
Surprise.
Really?
The Uruguayans are always find a way to be critical, and there was stuff to criticize today, but I think when you need to take a step back and realize that we're in the top 8 teams in the world, we have a reason to be happy.
When they were doing the national anthems and they were panning the Uruguayan team, it's like, these are very serious people.
Yeah.
That was my thought. That's an intense group of guys. You know,
Yeah. Well, that song, too, it's sort of like a very old classic national anthem with a lot of flourishes. So it plays well to the sense of drama. And Uruguayans like nothing else than a sense of drama. I think theater is one of the big things in Uruguay, and we express it in every part of the culture.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the game today, because obviously first headline, I suppose, is Suarez really had his big coming out party today. Forlan was the star in the group stage. Suarez, this was his day.
Yeah, and it's great for Luisito. That first goal, I think each goal showed something different about him. The first goal just showed intelligence. Uruguay got lucky on it, but he used his head and realized that there was some confusion happening in the back of Korea, and he took his chance, and he gambled, and he got it right. And then the second goal, I think, was just pure technical quality.
Yeah, that second goal was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, he really kept his head, and, you know, it was pouring rain, and he just threaded it, right? I mean, it was a really fantastic and expert shot, and I think probably the best goal, most beautiful goal of the tournament so far, likely to be one of the best of the tournament when we get to the end. I thought it was just brilliant. A number of people were sort of kind of commenting that they played an ugly game or a conservative game, or, you know, and I actually think that's a little bit unfair. I think that you can only say that if you don't appreciate the art of defending. And they were four periods in the game playing just absolutely amazing, amazing defense. And you had this strange, almost surreal period where Korea seemed to have the ball forever, forever. And it didn't mean a thing. I mean, it just didn't mean a thing. And I think I can see why people say that wasn't sort of fun to watch, but I found it really interesting. I thought it was sort of a little bit of cat and mouse, you know, just sort of batting them around before finishing them off. I mean, anyway, I just thought I liked today's game for Uruguay, and it made me think that we might see them go pretty far.
I see what you're saying. It was a little tough to see Uruguay give the ball to Korea for that long. It was one thing against Mexico where we scored and gave them the ball because a tie would have gotten us through top of the group. Here, a goal was a problem, so we gave them the ball for an hour, and then they scored, and then we said, okay, now we're going to score again. As a nonpartisan, I could probably see how someone would analyze, well, you know, Uruguay wasn't going to pressure unless they needed to, and then once they needed to, they got a second goal. But, you know, for me, it was a slightly schizophrenic performance. Yeah. I would have liked them to have gotten a second goal before Korea scored, but Uruguay, to be a fan of Uruguayan soccer is to know suffering and make us suffer a little.
Yeah, I guess that's that sense of drama being played out there with sort of drawing that period out for as long as possible. And then, you know, what thrilled me was the way they just turned it around. I mean, South Korea scored, and then it was just a moment of transition, right, where very quickly on the attack, the next thing you knew, Suarez was in front of the goal, and it was in the back of the net. It was really astonishing. And I kind of think that sometimes the stronger teams have that ability to recover, and also a little bit of, I don't want to say it's a cynicism exactly, but they'll hold back a bit with a kind of, you have the sense of there being a plan. And that's how I felt when I was watching it, that actually Uruguay had a plan, even when they weren't in possession of the ball, which is not a bad effect, so speaking dramatically.
Lazar, I have a question about the guys on the team. My sense of them is that they're a really unified squad now. So two questions. We know now about Suarez. We all know Forlan's background. The other guys out on the field, only a few of them have somewhat high profiles in global football. They're all consummate professionals is what they strike me as. And why does this team seem to have such a strategic and coherent unity, whereas it's just as not true of so many teams, including teams with great national soccer cultures?
You know, that's a really interesting question that a lot of Uruguayans are talking about, because you know, even countries like England, okay, they don't all play on the same team, but at least they all play in the same country and see each other. Uruguayans are spread all over the world. I mean, a couple players in Portugal, in Spain, there's a guy who plays in Uruguay, Argentina, Turkey. But the Uruguayan team really is willing to play together and understand each other and suffer for one another. And I think it comes down to the coach. I mean, the coach, Washington Tavares, is someone that the players really respect. He knows how to combine. He has a quote on his wall from Che Guevara, which is, I believe that, you know, in toughness combined with love, that you need to be tough, but you need to combine it with tenderness. And I think the players respect him as a human being, which you really don't see in every team out there this year. And that because of that, because of his experience and that he's able to bring them together, they're willing to sort of listen to his plan. And I think you're right. He does put out a plan for each portion of the game, not even for the whole game, for a portion of the game, they score, he changes the plan, and they're willing to trust him, and trust goes a long way.
Well, he's a great coach. I mean, as a Boca Juniors fan, I remember when he came over, and Boca hadn't won a championship in, I don't know, almost a decade, and then he showed up and just created one of the great Boca sides and took them to two or three straight championships, and so there's a special place in my heart for Tavares.
Yeah, and he's had success in different places. You know, He had success in Argentina, in Uruguay. He took us to the World Cup, the last World Cup, and we passed out of the group stage, which was in 1990. He did very well for Cagliari in Italy, and he even went on to coach Milan in Italy. So I think that has engendered a little respect. And, you know, trust goes a long way because you know, I think we've seen that not every team is willing to suffer in this World Cup, and it's the teams that are willing to suffer for one another and trust their coach that are getting farther.
Well, now, you live in New York, and I'll have a question for you about being in New York City today in a second. So while it won't be a situation where Uruguay is playing USA, they will be playing Ghana, which is really more significant. They'll now be playing the one side with a significant sort of home field advantage in the World Cup. While it's true that there are probably are not many fans from Ghana who will be at the match, one can expect that much of the South African press will be highly attentive to Ghana, and the international press will be attentive to Ghana. So there's going to be a lot of hype now around their next match and their next opponent. How do you see that possibly affecting the side? And the other question I have for you about the side is, the one weakness I see is they seem to fatigue a little bit, Uruguay. That was the only thing, because I think they're really rock solid, but I feel like if they go past 90 minutes, they're going to be very vulnerable.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought today, actually, we saw the fatigue. Even Diego Forlan, who is a horse, was beat. I mean, he was walking a lot of the game. With Ghana, it's interesting. A couple things. I mean, Uruguay now is playing with house money. I think the goal is to get to the quarters. So once you're playing with house money, once you've gone to the quarters and you come home a success story regardless, you're willing to just go for it. So I think that plays in their favor. The thing against Ghana, you know, we played against South Africa and took them apart at home.
Right.
So I don't think playing an African team will be a trouble. But in 1997, Uruguay came in second in the under-21 championship World Cup in Malaysia, and we beat Ghana in the semifinals. And the older Uruguayans on this team are the same players as the older Ghanaians on this team. Your Steven Appiah and Sully Mutari, I believe, were on that team. So these guys know each other because they played a very tough match many years ago. So, you know, there's that there. We're playing with house money, and once you've gotten farther than you think you're going to get, you're not playing with fear anymore. So more than ever, I think we're just going to go for it and have some fun. And when players have fun is when you really see the best of them.
One final question, not really related to the Uruguayan team, but you're in New York City is where we're speaking to you. What was the scene around the second match there? Obviously, you're sky high, but was there a lot of hype around the United States game, and where did you watch the second game?
Yeah, I mean, every place, every bar in Brooklyn where I live was packed. I threw off my light blue Uruguayan shirt and put on my light blue 1995 USA jersey, and you know, packed into a bar, and it was great to see. You know, it's great to see people coming out and supporting the U.S. You know, people don't still completely know how to cheer. They get really quiet after the opposition scores, which is when you need to cheer the loudest, because that's when your team needs the most. But you know, people were out there and excited, and I'm very proud of the U.S. I mean, this is a team this is the best USA team that I've ever seen, and I think they can lead with their heads held high.
Beautiful background ambiance of Brooklyn there.
New York City sounds.
That's right.
Yeah. One of these days, we're going to have everybody singing You'll Never Walk Alone.
Lazar Trishan's great blog is nomoreonionbags.com. Thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game, and you can be assured we'll be talking to you again in a few days.
My pleasure. Vamos away.
And that's our show for today. I'm Alan Minsky, and I want to thank Jennifer Doyle, Pablo Morales, and our guests, Nick Green, Dave Zirin, and Lazar Trishan. Tune in again tomorrow for The People's Game.